soul returning from far away.
Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino. On this episode, we talk with Israeli-based author, musician, artist, and inventor David Green. He grew up in Toronto and was in the music business as a songwriter at the young age of 16. From there, he taught beginners on many programs, including educational programs in Israel, as well as visiting groups from around the world. He lived in the old city of Jerusalem in his early years of his marriage. And then years later, he wrote his first book, A Book About You, which deals with helping people find their individuality. As an artist, he spent time in the film industry, but for his livelihood, he invents and patents technology. These days, he is working on the sale of Ensoles.com, a technology, to one of the major shoe companies. And these days, he also lives in Israel. He's happily married with 8 kids and 16 grandkids. He has a great insight and great stories. Enjoy this interview.
Hey, it's Joe Dimino. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Hey, thanks for taking a minute. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
I promise that this audio will be good and clean, so just letting you know up front,
okay.
It'll be good.
So
before we get into the plethora of things that are very interesting about your life, you got a lot going on, from the music to film to inventions, Israel, all that. I want to know, how did you deal with COVID? What was that period like for you? How did it change you?
I was in my house most of the time with my family, and it was actually a very bonding time. I enjoyed it in many ways. It was a great way to write a lot of music, work on creative stuff, and I'm more of an introvert, so it was a very natural setting for me. And My kids were here, and we had a great time together, and there was a gradual process of that changing, but we're all happy to get out of it, but there was something very special. It's sad. There's a situation where sometimes when there's like missiles flying into communities here, people have to go into bomb shelters, and I remember hearing a story of somebody, of a kid who said that, you know, he wishes the war wasn't over, because when they're in the bomb shelter, everyone got along so well, because there was like a unity of everybody going through something difficult together. So in a way, COVID did a similar type of thing. You know, we don't want COVID, but the flip side of it is that it brings out a lot of good in people, and we enjoy that together.
So where exactly are you located right now?
I'm in a city called Beit Shemesh, which is about a half hour away from Jerusalem.
Interesting. So
yeah.
Before we get into that part of your life, certain parts that I want to delve into, I want to go back to the very beginning. Talk to me about where you were born and raised. Kind of, how did you get this motivation to be in the arts and music?
Well, I grew up in Toronto, and at a very young age, I can't remember, maybe 4 or 5 years old, I started playing piano. And I loved it, and it was a part of me. I didn't connect very well. Like, I must have been too ADHD to do well in playing written music. And I still played classical music, but it was much, much harder for me. So composition became my main focus. And I started getting into jazz, which is a natural thing as a composer, because in jazz you're, improvising and playing music as you make it up at the same time. And I had a incredible trumpet player named Freddie Stone in Toronto that I used to play in a very avant-garde jazz band with him. And we used to play like on a regular basis. But then I started getting more into pop music. And by the time I was 16, my closest friend was my lyricist, and we went out to California. And we started breaking into the music scene there as little kids. And we lived actually for a while. We made friends with Ronnie Laws and his band. And they were extremely talented players in R&B. And we lived in one of their houses for a while. And we just rubbed shoulders with like really good musicians. And that helped improve the quality of our own music. And eventually... a wild story took place. I was 18, and I recorded an album with a singer in Toronto, but it had too much of this like clean Canadian sound to it. So I got hooked up with a guy who won numerous Grammy Awards before, named Gene Page. And Gene was nominated for a Grammy Award, and he couldn't accept it because he was busy probably recording another Grammy Award. So he asked me if I would go accept his award on his behalf. And what happened was I got in a limousine with a tuxedo and my pass, and I went down there. And on the highway, on the way there, I was very nervous. And there was someone who gave me something to relax me, and it worked for about 20 minutes, and then it wore off. And I think that's when I became religious. I prayed to God that he wouldn't win, so I wouldn't have to stand up in front of millions of people and it looked like like a fool. But it was after the Grammys, there was this party for anyone who was in the business. They had this special pass to this big party, and each room had a different thing. Count Basie's band playing in one, then they had the disco room. And I went to a room where they had a beautiful spread of food and televisions playing all around the room of the Grammys, because people wanted to see if they had an artist that had performed on the Grammys. They wanted to watch it over and over again and see how they did. So I was there, but I had somewhat of a snobby, jazz background, so I wasn't allowed to enjoy pop music too much. But then, I won't say who it was, but there was a musician there who was like my idol. He was like my God. It was the king of jazz fusion, and he had a hit record that like crossed over into the pop market. And that was my dream, is to be a jazz musician who did really well in the pop market, like Steely Dan, that kind of sound. And he was more progressive, but I looked at him. I saw my God in front of me, and he looked totally depressed. And I had a flick in my mind at that point where I said to myself, wait, why am I running so fast, so hard, pushing my whole life to try to be like this guy here? And he doesn't look very happy. And it was a realization I had at that point that first I have to be happy and then I have to be a musician. But I can't depend on my music to make me into a happy person. And I took a major change at that point. I decided, I was 18 at the time, and I decided, I'm going to go to college and go to music school. So I went to Bloomington, Indiana, which has a very good music school there. And I found everybody there wanted to be like this musician that I met in Hollywood. And they were all running after being that. And I'm thinking, why are they all trying to be that when that's not necessarily what's going to make them happy? Something deeper inside has to make a person happy. And that was what actually led me to come to Israel. There was nothing better for my music than leaving music school. Because in music school, in a way, it's like a different religion. It's a religion of art. You have to be artsy. You have to be unique. You have to be creative in a way that's different than everybody else. And that became the goal, was to be different. And my goal really was to express what my soul wanted to say. But how can you express what your soul wants to say unless you're in touch with your soul? So in Israel, what happened was it's sort of like an amplification of the soul. It's like it's a way of hearing my inner self. And the more I heard my inner self, the more my music started to reflect that. And I got more in touch with myself, and I made a jazz band there, and we used to perform every Saturday night. And I started getting a lot of gigs, writing music for various things. And the music that came out of me was just so much more sincere, because it wasn't fitting into this, artsy, or trying to be sound like Schoenberg or Stravinsky. I was trying to sound like me, and it was just so much more fulfilling. And that was all part of the process of what led me to becoming more religious and more, connected to God and more expressing that spiritual part of who I was. But using my music to do so helped me tremendously, both for my music and for myself. And uh, eventually moved here, got married, and thank God I live a very fulfilling life here with a blend of various things. Over time, I became more involved in studying, and eventually I wrote a book called A Book About You, and that was a book that I wrote out of initial concern that if I became observant, then I would lose my identity. And as more I learned, it was the opposite. I felt that I learned that the more you learn about who you are, and as an individual, you're discovering what God created you to be. And He made everybody different, just like we all look different. So too, our souls are different. Our souls are here to express something different than everybody else. So I wrote a book called A Book About You, which was to help people discover their individuality. What's unique about you? How do you know what's unique about you? And this is very helpful for people deciding what career to take. If they want to get married, it helps them understand the differences between them and their spouse. That self-discovery became a theme of classes that I used to teach here. So I had it come out with a publisher here in Israel, and then a company called Morgan James read it, and they loved it, and they asked me if I could put out a version that was more for a general public rather than specifically the Jewish community, and that's now on Amazon as well. So that was an exciting transition that took place. Then, as I started studying a work called Tanya, which is a Hasidic masterpiece, I started writing drawing pictures of what it described in the book as being how the soul works, and drawings showing how to interact with the mind and the heart, and how the soul is not just this abstract thing, but is actually something which we have tremendous amount of wisdom to learn about how it works and what it is. And so I found myself drawing pictures of a soul. And so I wrote a book called Pictures of Your Soul. And that just came out now, and it's in the Jewish bookstores in America. But hopefully it'll spread beyond that. And, it's something where it basically is built on a number of questions that people think you can't answer. Like, where is a soul? How does a soul stay in a physical body if it's not if it's spiritual and the body's physical? And it helps a person go from various struggles they have in life and lift themselves up to having that sort of clarity of spiritual awareness that helps them feel more alive and happier. And, what happened was I found, to enhance the book, I found a photographer that I knew from like 40 years ago who had the most stunning pictures of people who were on fire in prayer at the Western Wall. And so those pictures go throughout the book, and the text is built in and woven through the pictures. So that's the book that I just put out now, and that's what I'm really spending most of my time and effort trying to get out there.
That's fascinating. So I'm curious, at such an early age, do you ever look back and think how thankful you are that you got to that point? Because sometimes it can take people their entire lives to come to that realization.
Oh, yeah, I feel very blessed. But one of the things I discussed in my first book is that there used to be an era, like 1,000 years ago, where there were many prophets. I know that in the Bible that there's many prophets that you hear the writings of, but really there were thousands of them. And they had the ability to look at a person and see right into their soul and tell them what, like who they are and what their particular task is in this world. We don't have that anymore. But what they saw inside of us wasn't something they invented. They were able to see inside of us and see what's already there. Meaning that if I dig down deep enough, I can find a gold mine, knowing that the gold is there to be found. So if you dig deep enough in yourself, you don't need the prophet to discover who you are. It's just a matter of like getting rid of distraction, you know, turning off your phone for a while, work on mindfulness, becoming more self-aware. And eventually what you start to hear is what the prophets used to see. It's there for us to see ourselves. So I believe very strongly that when I looked at this musician, that I was hearing an inner voice that was so clear, and that sort of like woke me up to the reality that I had to change my path in life. And I feel very, very blessed that I did that, because there's another story where during that period of time, I was at my mother's at home, and my mother saw that, you know, her young 18-year-old was running all the time to try to reach a certain type of success that wouldn't make me happy. So she sat me down, and she made a cup of tea, and it was an herbal tea that had like very little flavor to it. She put it down in front of me, and I'm like thinking, like, why is she making me drink this tea? It's like, there's no flavor to it. I got to eat pizza and run out the door to try to make it big in Hollywood. You know, when you're running so fast, you can't even taste the food that you order. So she was a very wise woman, and she sat me down and she said to me, David, I want you to taste the tea. I'm thinking, taste the tea? There's hardly any flavor in this tea. How am I going to taste the tea? And she told me she wanted me to taste the tea. And she tuned me into the moment, and she made me aware, you know, of the fact that I was like running so fast and I was missing out life along the way. And so that kind of awareness that was a major transition for me really helped me in making a lot of major decisions in my life. The decision to go to school was very influenced by that. I felt like I was missing out on a certain, you know, phase of life that you're supposed to go through, you know, and I slowed down. And it changed my perspective tremendously. Like when I was in college, I was not there just to become famous. I was there to learn about myself and learn about, you know, how to express my music. But again, it was somewhat superficial until I came here to Israel, where I was able to really find myself and express who that is.
So I'm curious, with the myriad of things that you do, if you were in front of a group of grade school kids right now and you were at a career day and one of them looked up and said, what do you do for a living? How would you answer that?
That's a very good question. What I do for a living is I'm an inventor. I've invented some technology that I was able to sell well before, like the Nintendo games, Wii, and all those kind of immersive technology. So I invented something called Side by Side, and I sold it just before all these other technologies came out, so I didn't have the competition. So it was an immersive video technology. And I also have a company called Eat Insoles, which is, I sell a type of insole that I created that shapes to your foot as soon as you step on it. And, you know, I'm negotiating with different shoe companies to try to sell that. So I make my money from outside of the realm of my creative career. And I'm very happy that I do that, because I think that if I were to try to make money from my music, and even from my books, it would shape them differently. And I want to be as genuine as possible in the process. And I'm, you know, as a composer, there's a similar part of the mind that is inventive. And so, you know, I whenever I come up with an inventive idea, I go onto the website of the Library of Congress, and, you know, where the patent office on, and I look for other inventions and try to find a gap, and, you know, try to see if it's something that's worth patenting. So, you know, thank God I can make a good living from that. And then it leaves me a lot of time to work on my spiritual growth, teaching I did. I taught for many years a lot of these ideas from my books. But yeah, as a career, now you know I've made enough money from the inventions that I invest in various things, and so there's a business side to my life, but it's fun. But it's nothing like, you know, sitting down and writing music or recording music. For me, the most exciting thing is when I'm sitting in a studio with amazing musicians and hearing my songs come alive. So what happened was I wanted to get back into recording when I was here. So I got in touch with a guy who used to be the president of David Geffen Records. He also became observant here in Israel, and his name is Ronnie Vance. And he was also working for an Israeli company here, an Israeli music company for a while, a record company. So he was extremely well connected. So he put me in touch with a producer, this producer had access to the top musicians in Israel. In fact, one of the musicians who played on my first album is named Harvey Brooks. And Harvey Brooks played for Bob Dylan. He played Miles Davis' Bitches Brew album. Unbelievable bass player. And next thing I knew, he was in the studio with me playing my music. So it's an incredible thing, you know. You leave music school, you leave Hollywood, and you find yourself in a studio with the most amazing musicians. I think a lot of them came here to be in Israel, not because of their music careers, but because of that, they've sort of gathered here, and there's like incredible talent that I never dreamt of being able to work with.
So who would you consider like role models or heroes for you?
I mean, for piano player, Herbie Hancock, late Chick Corea, Joe Zawinu, you know, from Weather Report. Those were like, But really, the one who touched my soul the most was probably Stevie Wonder. I was actually invited to go into the studio, you know, to watch him record. Something happened because I was friends with Rita Ross, was Diana Ross's sister, who was in A&M Records at the time, and I was a staff writer for A&M for a while, and so she hooked me up with a lot of really good musicians as well, but. You know, there's musicians in the pop world that their ears are you can tell they would make great jazz musicians, but they want to limit that. Like I listened to a interview with Steely Dan where they needed to make some money for a while, so they wrote pop music for a record company, and the expression they used was they held back somewhat because they didn't want to pour out the creativity to such an extent when writing pop music, and on their own stuff when they started progressing more and more, it was extremely jazz oriented with the sort of rock thing that they didn't want to let go because it was part of their whole sound. So Steely Dan for sure was very, very influential. I think, you know, I mean, I grew up on Stevie Wonder. Thelonious Monk was a very big influence. I mean, minimalizing the music to be able to play just very few notes to get the message across, you know. There's quite a few, but I think, you know, the first ones I mentioned were probably the most prominent ones.
So if you can meet anybody alive on the planet right now and talk to them, who would it be?
That's a good question. Who would it be? I think I still have the connection to Stevie Wonder. I would probably enjoy just the thrill of meeting him. And it's just incredible talent there. I did have an experience that sort of ties into what we're talking about where Herbie Hancock came to Israel, and I was writing songs with a guy who was very close friends with his manager, David Rubenstein, at the time. And so we hosted Herbie Hancock while he was here. And like he came to my friend's house and played piano for us. And, you know, we talked a lot about philosophy and spirituality. He went down to the Western Wall with me to pray. And then he was giving a class at the Rubin Academy, which is a big music school here, for a bunch of jazz musicians who all wanted to be, you know, super cool. And in the cab on the way there, I said, "Tell me something, Herbie. If God forbid you were to lose your fingers, would you have what to live for?" And, you know, this is obviously a young rabbinical student asking philosophical questions. So I didn't know what he was going to say. And he said, "You know what, David? It took me many years to get to the point where I could answer that question. But I can finally tell you that I would be happy. I do have what to live for." So we went into the Rubin Academy, and all these guys are asking questions. What kind of bass do you do with a flat five chord and this and that? Like all these technical questions about different types of harmonies and stuff like this. And then he stopped all the questions and he said, "There's actually something that I want to tell you that I talked about with David on the way over here." And he asked them the question. He said, you know, "Would you be happy if you weren't able to play your music anymore?" And I felt thrilled to hear him share that question. But I think that's a question that people should ask, you know, musicians should ask themselves that, artists should ask themselves, because we tend to define ourselves by our art as opposed to express who we are with our art. And if we define ourselves by our art, it can lead to a lot of depression. And a lot of artists do suffer from depression because a major artist sold 40 million copies one year and they only sold 35 million copies and they can't handle it. There was a drop in sales, you know, because I would be delighted with 35 million copies. But, you know, we tend to define ourselves so much by what we produce as opposed to refining who we are and being able to express it. So Herbie Hancock was we kept in touch for numerous years after that, just on a social level, because we sort of were fascinated by a lot of discussions we had and stuff like that. A Keith Jarrett is somebody also I was very influenced by, you know, unbelievable composer and improviser, you know. People are amazing musicians, but they also have personalities, you know, and certain personalities I connected to more than others. And, you know, when I see interviews of people and seeing who they were behind the music, I like to find somebody who is humble and played their music from somewhere very deep inside. And I think Herbie Hancock and Stevie Wonder were those types of people, or are those kind of people.
You know, the one thing that I've noticed doing jazz interviews for as long as I have, I started this in 2011, and my goal was to not get jazz from books. I wanted to get it from firsthand accounts. I've seen a lot of walks of life in my life. I'll be 50 this year, and I've been through a lot of different paths. And I have never found a more humble, grounded, gracious, kind, and intelligent group of people than I have in jazz musicians. And I had no idea when I embarked on this that I was going to get into that, but I have consistently found the higher up the ladder you go, the more grounded and humble and wonderful they are, like Sonny Rollins. And I've never right. talked to Herbie, but I've heard that about him. I remember there was a young piano player, I don't know if it was Joey Alexander or if it was a youngster, he was 13, his name was Brandon, and his last name's escaping me, but he got the chance to talk to Herbie and totally disarmed him quickly and was just blown away by how grounded and human he was. So,
right. Exactly.
That's the beauty of this craft, is that that's just the way they are. It gets called as being kind of this highbrow, highly intellectualized realm. But at the end of the day, when you boil down the parts and pieces, these are just people that enjoy a bird floating across a summit just as much as anybody else. They are very into like kind of the natural wonder of life and
it's something that you can hear like if what's going on in your life has to come out in the jazz musician, unless you're playing like very, very like you know, there was a course in my college that in jazz, and I learned the least there in the jazz because they were basically teaching people how to play these riffs and work their way around these riffs and insert them all over the place. And it sort of sounded like a machine, you know, it's like a jazz machine. But the top musicians, you know, when we play jazz, it's because there's so much improvisation, then whatever you're going through at the time is going to come through. And so I think that it forces a jazz musician to look inside themselves more, and because that's what they're going to express. If a person's going through a hard time, or is losing touch with themselves, and then the music is going to feel that way. And so it sort of pushes a button that says, hey, you know, back up, you know, meditate a little bit, look around, experience the world, and then pick up your instrument and play it.
So I'm curious, from your perspective, to kind of humanize things here, everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your clients, those that hear your art and experience your inventions, but you ultimately live your life. You have a perception of you. Who do you think you are?
Yeah. I'm a person who is always trying to grow. I don't want to say I pride myself on that, but I definitely value the fact that I have grown a lot and gone through enough of different types of experience to be more selective in the way I want to live my life. I spend a lot of time devoted to my spiritual development and experience. And I thank God I'm in a very loving marriage where we're both secure enough to help each other grow in different ways. My wife is not a musician. She doesn't come from an artsy background, which is a blessing in a way, because if I would have married an artist, then we would be, you know, immersed in only that side of life. You know, she's taught me to come out and be much more expressive and accepting of other people who are not necessarily artsy, you know, and see the beauty in all kinds of people, as opposed to being in sort of a little cocoon of artsiness, you know. And I feel very redeemed through that. I feel very redeemed by what learning about spirituality through Judaism about life as opposed to about art. So I see myself as a person who's very blessed to have been exposed to and allowed myself to let go. In fact, one of my songs is called Let It All Go. And it's a song to myself about, you know, allowing myself to let go of a lot of the superficial faces that I've worn, masked over the years, and just let one go after another until the real me comes out. That's why my first album is called Journey to the Real You. In my book, A Book About You, what I have is QR codes throughout the book. I quote the lyrics from my songs because they're all totally consistent with the message of the book. And you can just listen to the song by scanning the QR code and enjoy the music that's saying the same message. And that's really who I am. I'm a person who enjoys being who I am and always trying to refine that and be more of who that real person is inside.
Beautiful, David. So how can anybody get your books, find out more about you and your music and your inventions and anything related to you on the web?
Well, I have a website, which is realyouproject.com. My books are on Amazon. You have to write in, like, A Book About You and David Green, because those words are used in a lot of searches. And then Pictures of Your Soul, David Green. There's on Instagram, although it's not filled with enough information yet, it's real.u.project. But the best place to start is my website, because there's links to everything else from there. So it's realuproject.com.
David, thank you. This has been very refreshing and revealing. I appreciate you opening up. Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks for tuning in to another Famous Interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, music, and spirituality around the globe. If you want to hear more interviews, visit the Famous Interviews with Joe Domino channel on YouTube. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.
Let the dreams of the night